compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, and I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. If you're looking for some unpredictable conversations, you've come to the right place. This is the Patrick Madrid Show, and I'd love to talk to you. Maybe you've got a question, a comment. Maybe you need a second opinion. Maybe you heard something that didn't sound quite right, and you'd like to run it by me. Whatever it may be, I'm here for you, and my number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. That's the same number all 3 hours, 888-914-9149. And if you want to send me an email, you can do that by going to the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. I'll also be on the lookout for your comments on Twitter. My address there is at Patrick Madrid. Now, one topic just briefly I want to get into. I have six sons, five daughters, all grown up now. And yet, a couple of my daughters are young enough. One in particular is young enough. She's in her early 20s, to be drafted. And you say, drafted? Why? Women don't get drafted. Well, heretofore, they don't. But news coming out of the Daily Wire here, Wednesday of last week, the Senate advanced the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, part of which would mandate the military draft for women, including my daughter, and maybe your daughter, or maybe you, if you're young enough and female. It advanced to the legislation, the legislation advanced to the floor debate stage by a vote of 84 to 15. So there's a lot of support for this bill to draft women. Now, let me just step back for a second. As you've heard me discuss before, and as I've said any time that this issue has come up on the program, I have nothing against women in the military, any branch, any type of service, even in combat. I don't particularly like the idea of women in combat, and I personally wish that things had not trended in that direction, but they have. So, okay, you know, who am I to argue against that? Especially if there are women who want to go and fight and they want to be on the front lines and fight in very dangerous circumstances. I am not complaining about that. I'm not against that. What I'm against is the drafting of women who don't want to be in the military. Now, in previous shows, I've gone in detail through my thoughts about that. So if you ever wanted to find out what I had to say on that topic, specifically about what my reasons for objecting to it are, you can find it easily by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and just type in women in the draft in the search bar, and you'll pull up all the shows in which I discussed it. But this is just a little update. The bill is advancing. Debate on the bill began on Thursday, and amendments to remove the provision on drafting women for the military might still be made. One of the initial setbacks for bringing the bill to the floor included disagreements between Republicans and Democrats about a provision relating to China that was eventually decided to be determined apart from the NDAA. The NDAA, again, is the National Defense Authorization Act. The Hill reported, quote, "The agreement to enter formal negotiations on the China bill also freed up the defense bill. Leadership now needs to work through hundreds of amendments to figure out which potential amendments can get a vote." Several of the senators who voted against bringing the bill to the floor were Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri. I'm sensing a pattern here. Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky. Some Democrats also voted not to bring the bill to debate, including Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey. The provision that would mandate a draft for women was first put into the NDAA by the House in September. The draft has not been used in decades, though men 18 to 26 still need to register in case it were activated again. I remember when I turned 18, I had to register for the draft. The draft ended in 1973, and the war ended in 1975. With the fall of Saigon. So even though I was too young for the draft, nonetheless, as soon as I hit 18, in 1978, I had to go into the post office and fill out that yellow form. All you guys, you did the same thing, or at least you should have anyway. Uncle Sam says they want you in that system. Now, I'm way too old now, so it wouldn't affect me. But it certainly would affect my daughter if this does go through, and it looks like it will. So if you want to read the story Again, this is from the Daily Wire. We'll have a link to that posted for you. And as I always say, I try to update you on stories like this so you can kind of stay abreast of what's going on. And if you have a young woman in your life who wants to join the military, great. You know, encourage her if that's what she wants to do. I've even given that kind of encouragement to some of my daughters. None of them actually did that. I do have a son who was 10 years in the Navy. He was a nuclear reactor operator on a nuclear submarine. I can't even begin to imagine what that what must have been like for him. But in any case, yeah, military service is honorable and good, and I recommend it. And I have nothing but encouragement for those who seek to serve our country that way. But I absolutely do not like the idea of drafting women. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to travel-related issues. My guess is that if you were traveling at all during the Thanksgiving holidays, you may very well have either stayed at an Airbnb or maybe you stayed at a hotel. Now, did you look in the drawer of the nightstand next to your bed? Typically, if you look in that drawer, you will find a Bible, the Gideon's Bible. The Gideons have been putting free Bibles in hotel rooms, you know, since time immemorial. But things are changing now, and this caught my eye. I thought I would share it with you. This is from Religion Unplugged. Why Bibles are disappearing from hotel nightstands. So maybe if you looked in the nightstand of the hotel you spent the Thanksgiving holiday at, you might not have found a Gideon's Bible. So here's what they say. Print, first of all, is slowly dying, and newspaper readers have migrated to the internet in recent years. What about those Bibles? They too seem to be slowly disappearing. The author points out that on a trip to Washington, D.C., he noticed that there was no Bible in his hotel room. This is part of a larger trend towards secularism. The phasing out of Bibles in hotel rooms is actually part of a steady trend across the country over the past few years. For example, in 2016, Marriott International, the world's largest hotel chain, typically supplied both a Bible and a Book of Mormon in its rooms. The reason being is that Marriott was launched by Mormons, and it may still be a Mormon-owned enterprise. I don't know whether it's a public entity or not, but it certainly has been Mormon in the leadership, let's say, since its inception. But the company decided to no longer put religious materials, and it's doing this now at two of its what they refer to here as its hipper hotel brands, Moxie and Edition, which are aimed at younger guests. In fact, Bibles used to be ubiquitous in hotel rooms. A 2017 survey by STR, which is a hospitality analytics company, it showed that 79% of hotels had religious materials in their rooms. And that was a decrease from 95% all the way back. Cast your mind back way, way, way back to 2006. Not very long ago. In 2006 and before that, it was a 95% rate of hotels having Bibles in the nightstand drawer. But as America becomes more secular and laptops and cell phones become more common, they too are ubiquitous now, the need for a physical Bible inside your nightstand drawer is growing more obsolete. Absolutely. It's Monday. So cut me some slack. I need some more coffee. Obsolete. There we go. Travel and Leisure reported that a majority of hotel franchises allow individual hotel owners to decide whether or not to stock their drawers with religious scripture. And as more hotel chains aim to attract millennial travelers, they're taking Bibles out of their rooms. And that, so that's an intentional thing because I guess they don't want to alienate that clientele. The Freedom From Religion Foundation, back in 2015, sent a letter to major hotel chains across the U.S. requesting that Bibles be removed from rooms. On its website, the group, which advocates for atheists and agnostics, said, "Many of your guests are free thinkers, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, or nuns, N-O-N-E-S, who are deeply offended to be charged high fees only to be proselytized in the privacy of their own bedrooms. Not only that, the Bible calls for killing non-believers, apostates, gays, stubborn sons, and women who transgress biblical double standards." I'm going to pause there for a second. This is part and parcel of a common attempt at trying to discredit the Bible as a whole by pointing to some of the things that were mandated in the Old Testament under the Mosaic Code that no longer apply and haven't for over 2,000 years. But in any case, I'd like to turn that around. I mean, the freedom from religion is incensed because there's a Bible in the nightstand drawer. And whoever opens the nightstand drawer? I mean, do you typically open the nightstand drawer when you're in a hotel room? I don't think most people do. I never do. I mean, if I want to check and see if there's a Bible in there, maybe I'll do that. But other than that, I mean, I don't really have any need for the drawer because I've got my suitcase and I've got plenty of surface space to put a cell phone and plugs and things like that. I don't really need that nightstand drawer. And if it offends them so much, if they're so deeply aggrieved because there's a Bible in the nightstand drawer, just don't open it. In the same way that on the television, there's pornography. So if the atheists are all up in arms and they're sending letters to all the hotel people demanding that they remove the Bible from the nightstand drawer because they're deeply offended, because they're being proselytized. You're not being proselytized unless you open that drawer and pick up the Bible and start reading it. There's no proselytization taking place. Maybe they're just worried that people might read the Bible and change their minds. Maybe that's what they're really worried about. But let's take the example of pornography. Why don't we just write letters? I mean, I would be happy to do that. Hey, atheists, you gave me a great idea. Well done. What if we all wrote letters to Marriott and all the other national hotel chains that carry pornography on those TVs? All you have to do, it's kind of like opening a nightstand drawer. All you have to do is pick up the remote control and click a button. And presto, that's on the screen. Which, by the way, is one reason why whenever I travel, I just never turn on the TV. I just never do. I mean, if it's on when I get there, I turn it off and I leave it off the whole time. And I just don't feel the need for the TV. But in any case, I would say that would be the equivalent of what the atheists are yammering on about with the Bibles. So when did all this start? This started about 100 years ago. In 1908, the Gideons International, an evangelical Christian group, decided to provide hotels with the Bible. On its website, the Gideons say that the tradition got started this way. The Gideons International is the result of a meeting between two men who wished to band commercial travelers together for evangelism. What began in 1908 as an association of Christian businessmen placing Bibles in hotel rooms has evolved into an expanding mission to provide scripture to all people in nearly every facet of life. Today, they say, we have taken more than 2 billion scriptures, this is Bibles, in more than 95 languages to 200 countries, territories, and possessions across the globe. Gideon's International said it has donated more than 1.4 million King James Bibles to hotels around the world between June of 2018 and May of 2019 alone. Let me reread you that figure. In a one-year space, just shy of 1 year, they distributed more than 1.4 million Bibles. Yeah, King James Bibles. That's too bad. I mean, maybe they can be convinced to supply Catholic Bibles, although I doubt that. Other denominations, such as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as Mormons, followed suit and also started stocking rooms at hotels, motels, and bed and breakfast with their own free religious literature. These days, however, guests have many online choices. Free Wi-Fi in rooms, for example, allows them to read whatever they want on their cell phones, tablets, or laptops. As a result, Christians also have many online choices when it comes to religious literature. The Gideons have an app now. So even if you don't have the Bible in the nightstand of your hotel room, if you're not staying at a hotel, you can fire up the app and read their Bible there. Also, Father Mike Schmitz, who has filled in for me any number of times, great guy, very popular Catholic priest and teacher, and he has, as I understand it, maybe the most popular religious podcast right now, and that is The Bible Every Day. That's not the exact title, but it's something along those lines. So he reads the Bible and comments on it every day, and apparently it's at the very top of Apple's most popular podcasts. So this is an era that is coming to a conclusion here, where people maybe before were relying upon Bibles, and maybe they didn't get into that hotel room even caring about a Bible there, but stop and think for a second about these hotel rooms. Don't think too closely about it, though, by the way. A lot of bad things happen in hotel rooms. A lot of bad things happen. And I'm happy, even though it is a King James version of the Bible, missing 7 books in the Old Testament, but that's okay. I'm glad there are Bibles in hotel rooms. Because let's say that somebody is contemplating suicide. Or let's say somebody is in the process or maybe has just completed the process of destroying his marriage. Or let's say there's a drug deal. Or let's say, I mean, we can use our imaginations and come up with all kinds of bad things that happen in hotel rooms. So picture a person who is maybe at the end of his rope and who is feeling the full force of the effects of sin and maybe contemplating suicide. Or maybe in the hotel room contemplating the sin that he had gone there to commit but hasn't committed it yet, and he happens to see the Bible and he happens to read through it, and maybe God reaches him that way and his life goes on a different course, a better course. Or people who maybe have been thinking about committing suicide and this is the last stop on their way to that bridge or that building or wherever they're going to do it, and they come across a Holy Bible and they read maybe the words of Jesus in the Holy Gospels, and they find a way out of this because God shows them through the light of Scripture. So there's a lot to be grateful for groups like the Gideons. I mean, they don't sell these Bibles, they give them away for free. So I'm in favor of that, and I hope that this doesn't die. I really hope that we see this continue, and we'll see what happens. I mean, digital is here. There's no way to change that. But wouldn't it be great if your children and grandchildren, at some point down the road, if they're in a hotel room, oh, yeah, I remember Grandpa used to tell us about this. Look, there's a Bible in the nightstand drawer. Let me read it. I think that would be wonderful. Now, I've got plenty more to tell you, and we have a few lines that are still open right now. So we're going to take a quick time out. We'll come right back and talk to you. I'm looking forward to that. My number is 888-914-9149. You can call now. We'll get you on the air. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I will be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back. The number again, 888-914-9149. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Let's go to Will in Orlando, Florida. Hi, Will.
Morning, Patrick. I was hoping to get your advice for how a family should handle if they have an adult child that's embracing the gay lifestyle instead of the cross.
Yeah.
How to handle that if they want to bring their partner home for Christmas.
Well, I'm sure this is a conundrum for many families. The more it goes, the more of a conundrum it is. But maybe you could try this. You could say, certainly, bring them over. We're going to talk about the Catholic faith. And we're going to discuss what the Bible says about issues like this. And just see what he says.
Okay, so it's okay to go ahead and kind of tackle the subject with him?
I don't see why not. I mean, chances are you won't have more than one opportunity to do that. Maybe you will, I don't know. But my guess is that it's an opportunity to share the truth. And if you could do that and, you know, just explain to your son and his friend what the church teaches, that may or may not move the needle forward, but at least it'd give you an opportunity to share the faith. And the other thing, too, is it may wind up being that he'll say, well, we'll take a pass. You know, if you...
Yeah, I mean, he's aware of what the faith teaches. That's why he left the church.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. Well, what I mean by that is, in other words, what you're doing is you're saying yes in a way that might make him say no. So if you and your wife and your family would feel uncomfortable, you can still say yes. You can still extend the invitation. Sure, come on. We'll be happy to have you. But just be aware that we're going to talk about these issues. And then he may say no. He may say, if that's the price of admission, then we're not going to be there. And you say, okay, it's up to you. He's welcome to come here. He's welcome to have, you know, Christmas dinner with us, that'd be fine. But if it's your son who says no, then he can't really blame you for it. But typically what happens, Will, is the parents are the ones who get blamed simply because they have a certain view on an issue like this. So If he says yes, you have an opportunity to evangelize. If he says no, then he only has himself to blame for not being there at Christmas.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
That might be one way to do it.
All righty.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate it. And Merry Christmas early to you. Let's go now to Donna in Santa Ana, California, that is. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Patrick. Have you heard of the Catechism of the Good Shepherd? And I just want to know if you think it's a good program for young kids.
I have and I do. I'm familiar with it, and it's very good, and I can heartily recommend it. Heartily recommend it.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. That was easy. I love the easy calls on a Monday morning. That's great. Thank you, Donna. Let's go now to Ellen in Philadelphia. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. A couple weeks ago, I heard one of the priests on Relevant Radio talking about the creative power of Satan, I think specifically, and he said that, if I'm recalling correctly, that the Satan and angels in general have no creative power. And I'm wondering if you could follow up on that and if you have any sources where I could actually find it in a book. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I must confess I didn't hear that comment from the priest, so I'm not sure exactly what the context was. But strictly speaking, angels don't have any creative powers. Unlike human beings who are lower than the angels, we have creative powers. We can make artifacts and we can make babies. So God lets us participate in his act of creation in that subordinate way. But strictly speaking, angels don't have that. They're not physical beings, obviously. They're pure intellects. So they don't have any creative powers. Now, there's an asterisk next to that. The devil has, by permission of God, the ability to, and this would be true of the angels, but the only way in which they would do that, well, let me come back to the good angels, okay? So the fallen angels, the church recognizes that the fallen angels do have the capacity to simulate creating things. So they can simulate a human body, for example, when they appear in the form of a woman or of a man. Or they have the capacity to simulate certain natural things like animals or fire, for example. So we read about St. Anthony of the Desert, whose biography was written by St. Athanasius in the 3rd century. And he talks about how St. Anthony of the Desert experienced many trials that were visited upon him by demons in the form of reptiles or animals or fearsome, you know, wolves, or they would set his place on fire and it looked as though everything was going to burn up, including him, but it was not real fire. And so as soon as he rebuked them or he invoked the name of Jesus, the fire would disappear because it wasn't really there. So to that extent, the demons have the capacity to simulate things, but they can't create them. They have no power to do that. Now, as far as the good angels are concerned, they, of course, enjoy a more elevated version of that power, but we never see angels, good angels, that is, using that power other than taking a human form. So when the angel Raphael wrestled with Tobit in the Old Testament, for example, that was a human body that he took the form of, but it wasn't a real body, and he didn't create it in the way that God creates things, or for that matter, in the way human beings create things. So that would be my answer to the question, independent of whatever the priest may have said that I didn't hear. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate your phone call. 888-914-914. What is the thing with the Monday morning mispronunciations? 888-914-9149. And by the way, Sarah, thumbs up. Sarah had suggested that we play Rocky Raccoon from the Beatles in relation to the story about the hotel room Bibles. I don't know if we'll have a chance to do that, but that was a great call, Sarah. Thank you. How about Dustin now in Sacramento? Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I am well. Not too bad for a sinner, in fact.
That's good. Just means God's looking out for you.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment when you was talking about Bibles being taken out of hotels.
Yeah.
It made me remember of when prayers was taken out of school. I mean, in my opinion, it's the same thing. It's going against our First Amendment of freedom of religion.
Well, I don't know if I would say it's the same thing, because in the case of the schools, that was a civil. I mean, it was decided that because public schools cater to children of all backgrounds, including irreligious backgrounds, that at least the argument went along the lines that it was an imposition on them to have a different religious view kind of pushed on them. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that was the way it was argued. In this case, it's not that there's any government mandate saying, get those Bibles out of those hotel rooms. It's not like that at all. It's just simply, in the case of the atheist group, they're complaining because there are Bibles in the hotel rooms and they feel as though they're being proselytized. Now, maybe the Gideons just didn't have a good lawyer and he didn't really figure out how best he could, you know, stop that attack. I think a good lawyer could have done so. But I don't think the two are the same thing. They're certainly not. It's not the same. Let's say it's not the same reason that school was taken out of prayer was taken out of school and the Freedom From Religion Foundation wants to take the Bibles out of the hotel rooms. Do you see what I'm saying? And I don't think it's apples and apples in this case.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, in that case, I can't but wonder, well, I mean, of course, no, I'm on my way of becoming Catholic. I've been doing
RCIA.
So I have the same problem on Monday mornings too.
Here's some coffee.
I've been under the Catholic study program and been on my way of becoming Catholic, converting to Catholicism.
Congratulations.
But, so naturally, I'm only going to pray to God, pray to Jesus, do my devotional prayers every morning and every night. But in the case with taking prayer out of school, like to cater to all the other students who are not Catholic or Christian, why can't they just do something for them as well as letting them pray or have them or offer prayers, have prayers in school for them as well? Yeah. But of course, like I said, I believe in the one true God. So,
yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations on your journey into the Catholic Church. That's exciting, Dustin. And I hope that listening to Relevant Radio has helped you along the way. Let's play out some scenarios.
I'll listen to your show every morning.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So let's say you had a kid in school. Let's say you had a fifth grade kid. And he said, Daddy, they're not only allowing prayer in schools again, but an imam from the local mosque came and read from the Quran. I wonder how you would feel about that. I don't think I would feel very good about that if I had a kid in school and he was raised Catholic. I don't want him exposed to Islam, at least not at that age and not in that context.
Perspective, I guess.
It is. And that's all I'm trying to say is that in a scenario like that where the government says this is forbidden, whether or not the government is wise to do so, that's a separate argument. But if they by law say this is, you can't do this, you can't have prayer in school, that's different from a hotel deciding because they got a letter from this angry atheist group and they decide on their own volition to no longer allow the Gideons to put Bibles in hotel rooms. They can do it or not do it. No one's compelling them to do it. They're just simply making what they think is a good business decision. In the case of the schools, it's the government that is saying no, and it's under the force of law. Hotels are not bound by law to put Bibles in or take Bibles out. They can do whatever they want. So when are you coming into the church then, Dustin? Will that be this coming Easter?
Yeah, a second, please.
I tell you, if you're having phone difficulties, I understand. Well, I'll just say once again, welcome home, Dustin. I know it's a little bit early, but hopefully the day will come soon and we can all rejoice with you together. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Mercedes now in Philadelphia. Hi, Mercedes.
Hi, Patrick. I understand Jesus as the Son of God. Could you please explain why Jesus is also called the Son of Man?
Oh, yeah. Well, interesting to note that in the Gospels, Jesus is the one who calls himself the Son of Man. Others call him the Son of God. Jesus doesn't call himself the Son of God, even though he is. So as I understand the theological opinion here, the understanding is that it was Jesus' humility in referring to himself as the Son of Man, even though he is indeed the Son of God. You know, he talks about God as his Father, and his Father sent him. So he doesn't in any way skirt the issue that he is the Son of God. But my understanding is that the Church Fathers and others who comment on this say that this was his humility in speaking of himself in that way.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's fitting because Jesus, look at his humility in becoming a little baby and being born in a manger in a backwater town in the middle of nowhere. Look at his humility at not living in a grand palace with fine clothing. He was an itinerant preacher, and he tramped the dusty roads and byways of the Holy Land. He was very humble, as is keeping with who he is. So this fits that profile perfectly. Thanks, Mercedes. Great question. How about Rich now in San Francisco? Good morning, Rich.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I was just curious. How is it that the Vatican ideology considers people who genuinely believe in God but have no particular use for anything to do with the so-called Christ? They don't really believe in them. Would that be recognized as valid?
What do you mean by the so-called Christ? What does that mean?
Well, the term, it's more a label. It's not. It has been discredited by a biblical scholarly research in recent times and for decades.
What has been discredited? The term Christ, Christos in Greek, or Messiah in Hebrew, it just means anointed one. How has that been discredited?
What it means.
Okay, well, we're not going to argue that point. That is what it means. But what do you mean it's been discredited? What has been discredited?
Well, it's the scholarly researcher, and he's also proven that fact. That okay. It's a fact that doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
You're not completing the sentence for me. What is it that has been what is it that has been disproved?
Discredited. Refuted.
Okay, I'll give you another shot, Rich, then I've got to move forward. What is it that you think has been discredited and refuted?
The claim that the term Christ means the begotten Son, it doesn't mean that.
I didn't say it meant that. I said that it means anointed one, or in the Hebrew, Messiah.
In a particular branch of Judaism, he was not.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Edith in Chicago. Good morning, Edith.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious. A couple of times our priest asked us to raise our right hand while reciting or in a response to, you know, sometimes they do the short form of the baptismal promises mm-hmm. during Mass.
Right.
And he asked us to raise our right hand, like if we were doing an oath. Is that a common practice? I never heard of it, and I never done it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would need to consult the Book of Rites so I could see whether or not it calls for that to be done. I don't remember now whether I've seen it or not. It may be there, but there's nothing inherently wrong with it. It's a gesture that demonstrates that you're seriously on your word, making a promise or a vow or something like that. We do it in a courtroom, so where somebody swears to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, by lifting your right arm at that right angle, it has a significance to it, which further heightens or accentuates the gravity of what you're doing. So that's what mm-hmm. it means. There's nothing wrong with it if the priest were to ask you to do that. I just don't know whether it's prescribed in the book of the rites, the liturgical rites that the church has. It may be there. I just haven't looked for that. I don't know. But if you did it, or if the priest asked you to do it, I don't think there's anything at all wrong with that.
Okay. So it's just a matter of find out whether it is in the rite.
Yeah. So this is during the profession of faith at a baptism. I mean, I don't recall ever in my life, and I've been at many baptisms, ever seeing people being asked to raise their right hand. It's always, you know, you make the profession of faith audibly, but there's no gesture involved. Now, is this where it was? Was it at a baptism, or what was the circumstance?
No, at Mass, during Mass.
Okay. It sounds like it was a bit of embroidery. It sounds as though the priest had added that in on his own volition as a way to try to heighten the sense of what was happening. In that case, no, I don't think that's ever called for by the church. But okay. At the same time, there's nothing wrong with it, you see.
Okay.
Okay. I'm just trying to put your mind at ease.
Yeah. Okay.
Got it. Well, thank you, Edith. I appreciate that. Why don't we take a break and we'll come back. We just had a line open up. You can call now. There it is. Rocky Raccoon. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. I'll be right back. Please stay right there. Only to find Gideon's Bible. Rocky had come equipped with a gun. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principalsclasses.com/Madrid.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's see. I want to share with you a little bit of audio. This is from a TikTok guy. What's his name? He goes by, I'm trying to find it. He goes by 80s humor tumor, whatever that means. And he's talking about the long discussed belief that Facebook listens to you through your phone or through your computer. And he's got about 90 seconds or so of him talking about his take on this coming from a tech background. Here's what he says.
They're not listening, but I know you're not going to listen to me when I say that. So here's an experiment you can perform for yourself to see if they're listening to you. You need a friend for this, and you need a lot of patience. So you and a friend or a family member or someone agree to talk about a product or a service anytime you're together. The key is you can only talk about it when it's just the two of you and no one else is listening. And during the test period, you can never interact with anything that mentions the product in any way. That means no liking on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or TikTok or anywhere else of anything that mentions this product in any way. So no interaction with the product, only talk about it. And only when the two of you are together, and keep your phones handy while you do that. More than likely, what you'll discover is as long as you're just talking about it, the product doesn't show up in ads. And then if that doesn't happen for several weeks, so you have lots of conversations and the product doesn't show up, then one of you do a single search for the product on a device and then see how long it takes before that person gets an ad for it and how long it takes before the other person gets an ad for it. And you'll quickly discover that your conversations are ignored, but the second you do any kind of text input on a device, all of a sudden, everything gets picked up immediately.
Does that make you feel any better, Jim? Do you feel better about that now?
I don't know that I do.
I think they're listening. And I have some of my own anecdotal evidence for that. And it happened on this program. It's probably happened many times before. I just never noticed it. So on this program, maybe two years ago, something like that, maybe 3 years ago, a lady called in and... Well, let me take a step back. So on the show that day, we talked about this topic. We've talked about it any number of times before. What about the Amazon Echo and the Dot and the Alexa and all the different devices that we have in our homes? And what about your phone, etc.? To what extent are they actually listening to you? And then maybe, even if not in any nefarious way, they're phoning home to the mothership and somehow that gets entered into your profile and then they target market you. We've talked about this many times. So I happened to be talking about it that particular day and an unrelated topic came up with one of the phone callers. She called up and she said, is it, according to the Catholic Church, would it be sinful, would it be immoral to have a medical procedure to remove excess skin? Now, how often do you talk about that? Probably not very often. It's not a topic that I think I've even discussed more than a handful of times in my lifetime. But that was her question. What if you lose a lot of weight and you're dramatically thinner than you were a year earlier and you've got all of this excess skin and you go in for a procedure to remove the excess skin? Is that immoral? So I gave her my thoughts on the topic. And by the way, my thoughts were, no, it would not be immoral. If it's a genuine medical condition and it was prescribed by a doctor, yeah, it's a treatment and it's not immoral. So maybe 15 minutes go by and another lady calls into the program and she says, you'll never guess what happened. I said, what? She said, I've been listening to your program on my phone on the Relevant Radio app. And I heard what you were saying about, you know, the phones are listening and okay, whatever. And then I heard the story, the lady called in about the excess skin removal. And she said, I am not kidding you. She said within like 10 minutes, her phone, when she was looking at a website or something, was serving up ads to her for excess skin removal. For excess skin removal. She said, I don't need excess skin removal. I'm skinny. I don't need it. I've never searched for it. It's never even entered my mind. It's never been a topic of interest to me or any of my friends. Or I mean, I've never been around this topic before. But I hear it on your program. And within 10 minutes or so, the ad server on my browser is serving me ads for excess skin removal. How do you argue with that? I mean, seriously, how do you argue with that? I cannot explain that away. To me, that is beyond the limits of probability. Now, Occam's razor says that the, you know, in most cases, the simplest solution is usually, or the simplest answer is usually the correct answer. And the simplest answer in this case is the phone was listening and it heard me talking about excess skin removal. It decides, oh, okay, well, then she must be interested in that for whatever reason. So it starts giving her those ads. I really do believe that this does happen. No question about it. And I think that that TikTok influencer, you know, he may be right in a certain sense, or that test might be correct in a, under certain conditions. But I really don't think that it's a, that they're not listening to you or me, which is another reason, by the way, to put your, turn your cell phone off, or better yet, keep it in your car when you go to church to go to confession. I've been doing this for years. And not that my confessions are going to be particularly earth-shattering, but I just don't want anyone listening. I want the priest and I want God to listen to my sins, and that's all. Of course, my guardian angel is there too. But other than that, I don't want it. I don't. No one else needs to know. So I've been turning my phone off and leaving it in my car for many years when I go to confession. Just word of the wise, that's all. I mean, because if your phone is on and it's in your pocket or it's in your purse or it's in your hand, as the case may be, when you go to confession, I mean, if it's listening for excess skin removal operations and can serve up an ad, wouldn't it be spooky if you went to confession, you had your phone with you, and suddenly the ad server is serving you up ads for the thing you just confessed? I don't. That's not an experiment I ever want to undertake. 888-914-9149. How about Luke in California? Good morning, Luke.
I was listening about near-death experience at your
sure.
show.
Yes.
One of the show, and it described how people were able to describe the details after they come back to life. So my question is that if memory is part of your brain, which is a physical thing, how is memory is impacted to the soul?
Say that again. If memory is... Say that last sentence again, please.
How is memory impacted on the soul? I mean, if the soul does not have any physical matters, how is it retained memory?
Okay, fair question. Well, memory, of course, is the result of the physical input that our senses give us, the memory of what we see, what we taste, what we touch, etc. So those stimuli that come to us through our senses are converted into a mental image. And the mental image that you have of your parents or of the house you grew up in or of your car. Maybe you're sitting at home right now. You don't see your car, but you can easily picture your car. Well, these are part of your memories. So you remember things that you see and touch. So the soul has the capacity to convert the physical sensory input from that your body receives to these images. Now that's an action of the soul that is called the imagination. So we can create these images, which is part of our memory. Now the mind is using the physical organ of the brain to accomplish this process of your senses providing input that then becomes changed into or becomes these mental images in your imagination. But the mind ultimately, the soul ultimately, does not require the brain in order to have all of these things in it, meaning your memories as an example. So at death, and you're talking about near-death experiences, at death, when the body and the soul separate, the soul is no longer working together with the brain and the other sense organs as well, for that matter. The soul is no longer operating those and receiving information from them. Now the soul is independent of those things. But all the things that were part of that soul's experience, so memories, etc., all of those things remain in the soul. They don't require the body to remain in the soul, but they do require the body to come into the soul, if we can speak in those terms. If you didn't have sight or hearing or any of your senses at all, if you had no way in which to experience the world around you, none of these things could ever become ideas or memories in your mind. So the body is necessary, working with the soul as a composite to form these memories, but the soul is capable of retaining them without the body after death. Is that what you're referring to?
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I recommend a book I think you'll like?
Sure.
It's called Science and the Afterlife Experience by Chris Carter. And it's a very interesting book. It takes it from a scientific perspective, and it looks at the phenomena of out-of-body experiences after, you know, like, what's the word I'm looking for here, where somebody, they die, they go flatline for 20 minutes or half an hour, clinically dead, and yet they come back to life. And their body and soul, it seems, maybe separated for a time or got close to separating. And so in this book, what he does is he catalogs many of these bona fide examples from a scientific standpoint. I thought it was very interesting. You might find it interesting too.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. How about Lisa now in Brookfield, New Jersey? Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I just purchased a new international version of the Bible for my niece, mm-hmm. and I'm Catholic, and I just want to make sure that that's accepted by the Catholic Church. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it's not. The new international version is a Protestant Bible, so it only would be missing some of the books from the Old Testament, it would also have footnotes and cross-references that would be maybe a bit tendentious. In terms of, you know, it wouldn't be a Bible that the Catholic Church would approve of. But there are many good alternatives. Is it too late to return that Bible and exchange it for a Catholic Bible?
No, I could still return it. I haven't actually received it yet. I ordered it from a television shopping network. So,
okay.
You know, when I get it, I could just easily return it. It won't be a problem.
That's good. Yeah, I would suggest either the Ignatius Bible, which is the Revised Standard Version Catholic edition, and there's a second edition of that. I would recommend the Augustine Bible. It's another modern translation, but it's also quite good, and it's a Catholic Bible. So you can go in that direction, or you can go with the New American Bible. The problem with the New American Bible, unfortunately, is that it has some really tendentious, and in some cases, I would say, incorrect notes in the explanatory sections. So those would be things you'd have to look out for. But if she's not really a well-trained or if she doesn't have a lot of background in Scripture, maybe stick with the Ignatius Bible or the Augustine Bible. I think that would be a better bet if you ask me. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Yeah. Okay, good. I wasn't sure if your phone was working. You're welcome. Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate it. Well, let's see. We're going to take another break, and we will come back in just a few minutes. When we do, I was surprised when I saw this headline in the New York Times. I'm going to share this with you, and I think this is not only noteworthy because it appeared in the New York Times, but also the reaction that many people gave it. Here's the headline. One chaste marriage, four kids in the Catholic Church. A son reflects on his parents' commitment, endorsed by the Catholic Church, to cohabit chastely as brother and sister to avoid mortal sin. Now, technically, the way it was written is, you know, it's correct wording. There's nothing in the way that it was printed that would be incorrect, but I think many people misunderstood the import of this headline, and I will explain to you what this is all about when we come back. This has to do with marriage and the things of marriage, so parents, just, you know, be attentive to your children if you think this, when I come back and I share this with you. There's nothing, you know, graphic or anything like that, but if the subject matter is not appropriate for little ones, you might want to usher them into the playroom for a while I share this one with you. But I'll be doing that on the other side of this quick timeout. If you want to call me, call this number, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back right after this.